You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, more Americans from across all age groups are living under one roof. In fact, since the 1970s, multi-generational living has doubled. Finances and family are two key drivers. Find out more and hear stories from listeners today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the political landscape has shifted in recent years. Some of the rules of modern politics may be different than they were even a decade ago. Our next guest points to former President Trump as an example of how politicians and parties function in our current media landscape and says that a new mixture of politics and entertainment extends beyond any one candidate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the world of politics change in recent years? Do you see politicians' image and perception becoming more important than their actual politics and policies? Are there candidates you've seen reverse that trend, take a more old-school approach? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's co-author of the new book, Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
Let's tackle this concept of politainment, politics and entertainment. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting. It's a term that a student of mine about 25 years came up with when Jesse Ventura was elected governor in Minnesota. And she at one point said to me that, you know, he's kind of like a combination of a politician and an entertainer at the same time. And she coined the word polytainer, and we eventually did some writing on it to say, well, there's really a new era of politics now. It's about how certain candidates for office, we call polytainers, really sort of feed off of let's say, a lot of, let's say, network news or, let's say, the social media, and they kind of are engaged in a symbolic, almost parasitic relationship about how now candidates who are good in terms of entertainment venues become very successful in campaigns, and of how oftentimes candidates now to reach people go out onto what? Onto entertainment platforms to reach people and not just appear on news, and how news increasingly, in order to be able to become profitable, to attract visitors, listeners, oftentimes uses entertainment venues or techniques to reach people. And so what we really decided is that what we're really looking at is Donald Trump is the most recent incarnation of how politicians, entertainment, and politics have really converged together.
And the title of the book is Trumpism. You say Donald Trump isn't the only person doing these things, but he mastered it in a way that matched up with the media landscape at the time. What are some of the things you saw him doing that that exemplified politainment, at least as it currently exists?
Well, let's think about Donald Trump before he even ran for president of the United States. Now, in a deeper sense, he was playing the New York media scene for many years. But what was it? For 15 years, he was the host of The Apprentice. He cultivated an image. He cultivated a brand. You know, so we had, you know, the Trump Towers, the Trump Estate, but Trump Wines, Trump Steaks. I'm trying to think of all the other kind of Trump things. But really what he did very successfully was to create a brand on television about who he was and his persona. And even when he declared for his presidency, you know, this was kind of a made for TV event. And to a large extent, we have studies that pointed out that in 2016, when he first ran, that the commercial media found that by covering him, they would get enormous numbers of viewership. And so Trump found that by appealing to the media, the skills that he honed would get him media attention. The media found that by covering him, that would generate viewers, which translates into dollars. And so they really sort of came together. And then also, I think where Trump was brilliant was in the sense of understanding how to master social media in terms of Twitter. And as president, he would start off every day early in the morning, let's say, send out two or three tweets that would then set the political and news agenda for the rest of the day. So he really understood ways of how to further his image, to help him politically, but at the same time, it served the interests of let's say mainstream media by giving them easy news stories to cover. So in some sense, they really were, again, in kind of a relationship built for one another.
Yeah, there's this concept called earned media in the PR world, yeah. Meaning I've gotten my person or my product or my company in the news without paying for an advertisement. And whatever people think about the politics of Donald Trump, he got a lot of that earned media on CNN in particular, or by, as you said, tweeting and getting coverage of tweets. I don't think I've seen anything else like that in politics.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, the estimates I've seen were somewhere in the area of about $2.6 billion, as in the B, billion dollars in 2016 that he got in terms of earned media. And he understood it's not just, you know, traditional news. It was going to be in, let us say, non-traditional sources, because as we know, not everybody's watching the news. Not everybody is reading a newspaper. People are going to social media. They're going to, and I talk about this in my book, take us back 20 years ago, you know, to the 2000 election. The nighttime talk shows, you know, Letterman, Leno, places like that were the place to go for coverage. Or think about it, if I work backwards in time, how did Bill Clinton in 1992 launch his presidential campaign, appearing on Arsenio Hall, and he played the saxophone? So we have this long legacy of where candidates understood how to go to, let's say, pop culture venues to be able to attract attention. But really, Trump, part of what the book is about, is how Trump understood and mastered this very effectively.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota, co-author of the new book, Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment, Blurring the Lines Between Politics and Entertainment, Cultivating Images, and Changing the Rules of Politics. You could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you have a recent or distant example of a major political candidate crossing the lines, harnessing the power of entertainment, ably or less so? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, at the heart of this, I think, is a changing media landscape. Once upon a time, you know, there were big, serious newspapers and just a few networks. And if I'm a politician and I talk about my policies, they probably cover it. Now there's so many different outlets, so much competition for our eyes and ears. Is this cultivation of an image, this politainment, what it takes to cut through the noise and get out there?
I think it is, in part, because in a fragmented media market, you've got to find all kinds of different places to be able to advertise. But additionally, also think about it here, that so I think effectively cutting through some of the noise, but also what I try to talk about in the book here is that even though we need to be thinking about the changing political landscape that the new media markets and fragmentation, you know, portend, I still try to discuss in the book, there's some basic essentials that never go away. And part of the book is talking about Trumpism, about how there are other candidates who are doing this, about sort of the polytainment landscape. But as you go through the book here, I basically discuss sort of the basic 10 rules of politics, and they're the fundamentals for winning campaigns. So, for example, my most important rule of politics, and I try to write these with pop culture references, is to say that what politics is like selling beer. At the end of the day, politics is still about having a clear message, a narrative, a story to tell. And if you think about, for example, Donald Trump's message, from back 6 years ago, whether you liked it or not, it's a different story entirely. It was what? Make America great again. He had a story. He had a message. And what I try to unfold in the book is these 10 different rules about appealing to your base, having a message, all about thinking about fact versus fiction, reality in terms of how you craft those messages. And so what I try to do is to say that what Trump really captures in some ways is both this sort of new reality of communications, but at the same time, grafts it onto some real basic rules about how you really do winning campaigns. And the whole art of the book here, it's not written for political scientists. This is written for the general public, is to say, let's take what we've learned about political science, what we've learned about real campaigns, and how do we now explain this to real people? And my co-author, Avery Gaylor, was a high school student, and I said to her, go help me come find with me pop culture references that appeal to your generation also. So what we're really trying to think about is how do we appeal to a new generation of voters? How do we run winning campaigns in this new political environment?
We're talking to political science and law professor David Schultz about his new book, Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think politics have become too much about emotions and entertainment? And what do you think it takes to win a campaign? Big ads that earned media, capturing the media's eye through entertainment type statements? Or is there a lot of old school stuff that still applies? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to David Schultz about his new book, Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Erica is with us in Lake Tomahawk. Erica, hi.
Well, hi there. You were talking about politainment, and I think two fine examples are Adolf Hitler and Joe McCarthy. Adolf Hitler discredited the media, and he was he was the whole show, and so was Joe McCarthy. He had not a leg to stand on politically, or even factually, but by God, he got in the news.
Thanks for the call, David. What do you think? Older examples?
I think there are older examples. I think Joe McCarthy is a great one. Again, my focus is on American politics, but clearly there's no question that Hitler understood how to, you know, manipulate the media, manipulate communication technologies. He understood very effectively, you know, how to play upon, and I talk about this in my book too, about how to play upon the emotions of people very, very well. The way I sort of trace it out here is that really sort of the road to politainment. I hadn't thought about Joe McCarthy. I thought about Dwight Eisenhower initially, you know, the first presidential candidate to run political advertising, or about how John Kennedy was really sort of the first made-for-TV president, or how in 1968, I think it was, Richard Nixon appears on the NBC show Laugh-In, understanding how to appeal to, again, pop culture references to help yourself. Or I was thinking of another Midwestern candidate at this point. I'm forgetting his name now. Remember the old show Love Boat? And there was, I think, Fred Grandy, who played Gopher
on Love Boat, yeah.
Yeah. He goes on to become a member of Congress, or Sonny Bono becomes a member of Congress using their persona. And the reason why I use the word persona is that they become manufactured candidates. It's not a real person. It's the persona they're running. Donald Trump ran as a persona, not as who he was. And that gets into one of the other themes of the book, where polytainment is about a world where what? Fact and fiction blur. And it's about setting up a world where you don't have to run on truth. You can run on image. You can run on really images and symbols that appeal to people.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Sid joins us now in Milwaukee. Sid, hi.
Hey, I would say that the stakes, like this, what hangs in the balance is far greater right now in terms of politics than before because of the sheer religious and ethnic diversity in the USA. I mean, we're kind of on the edge of where, like, people that want to continue the only thing the USA had in common from sea to shining sea was white supremacy. So that's taking away a huge portion of, like, the de facto pre-1960s culture. And as we get extremely ethnically diverse, it's essentially just a war between those that want to continue the traditional, quote unquote, America, and it becoming, you know, a new thing where that's not going to be the culture and it'll balkanize. I don't see a way out.
Sid, thanks for the call. How do you see a more diverse culture, David, affecting the way political campaigns work?
It certainly challenges them in a variety of ways, because first it's going to mean perhaps finding all the different venues to reach different populations. It's also going to mean having to refine your strategies in terms of messaging. you know, for many years, I taught in a school of business. And in that school of business, we talked all about corporate communications. And there used to be this old joke that said, for advertising and messaging, I know half of my advertising is a waste. I just don't know which half is a waste at this point. And what I'm getting at here, if we think about, and this is part of what polytainment is about, if we think about candidates as being, and campaigns as being businesses and products to be sold, how do we market a candidate like a Donald Trump? How do we message them? And the plurality or our growing ethnic diversity in this country only creates more of a challenge in terms of figuring out how to use more multimedia strategies to be able to reach people and to appeal to different groups with different messages. And again, what Trump was good at doing was identifying a core base of people, a core base that's with him. Remember, he once said, what was it? I could take out a gun on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and they wouldn't abandon me or something. He understood his core base, how to work with them and how to message to them. And then he also understood, again, how to get that earned media time, how to message in ways like Make America Great Again, to say something without saying anything.
We are talking to David Schultz. His new book is Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. Let's bring on another caller. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. Say, I totally get the point the author's trying to make with the politainment. I see it. But ultimately, isn't this just empty calories of potato chips? And we're still longing for something more sustaining and fulfilling, and that the latest flash in the pan is just going to go and the next bright, shiny bauble gets our attention and political careers are gone. And here we are suffering because of it.
Kevin,
thank you.
Thanks for the call. What do you think, David?
I think the caller is exactly right, that we are chasing one shiny ball to the next. It's almost like that whatever's trendy today really sort of will capture our attention and sell. It sells a candidate. It sells an image and so forth. And that's exactly the whole point here, is that if the goal is for a candidate to capture our attention in a noisy world, conversely, if it's the goal of for-profit media to be able to figure out ways of attracting viewers, the marriage comes together to figure out what's the shiny object that we talk about today that will appeal to both helping the candidate and appeal to selling airtime, selling advertising, et cetera, et cetera. And the depressing part about it, I think the caller is exactly correct in this, is the sense that it's not about substantive public policy. It's not about saying, let's actually accomplish or do something. It's, I think I point out at one point, it's about image is everything, reality is nothing. Say that you're making America great again, or say that we're doing certain types of things. That may be more important than really actually doing things. I mean, again, going back, and the focus is on Trump here, you know, is that Trump in so many ways represented, for example, the antithesis of let's say what evangelical Christians supported and what they wanted, yet they supported him because he said the right things. It may be what you say, not what you do.
Thanks for that call. David, getting back to your rules of politics, one thing that struck me here in Wisconsin, post-election on the Republican side of things, there's a fairly heated email thread about why they didn't win the race for governor. And there's the debate, aside saying we put too much money into the high-priced consultants, not enough into the oldest school of politics, people going and knocking on doors and persuading people to go to the polls on our side. You address both sides of that in your rules, and this isn't the first time a campaign has had that post-mortem debate.
You're actually correct here. I want to take us back to 2016 when Hillary Clinton lost the presidential race, and she lost it because, in part, she didn't follow the basic rule of politics. The way I describe it, in Minnesota, she lost the caucuses. She lost the primary in Wisconsin, lost the primary in Michigan. What does she do? She takes the votes for granted, figures that, guess what? Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, and Pennsylvania have nowhere else to go. In those first three states. She never comes back to campaign during the general election, and she loses two of those three and loses the presidency. And in her closing days of her election, instead of nailing down her base, she goes to places like Arizona and Texas. And what I try to argue is that she violated one of the most fundamental rules of politics, which is the idea of saying what? Mobilize your base, take every campaign, ask for a vote. Don't assume it's yours. And I think partly what we saw in Wisconsin this year is Republicans, you know, violating that. But also at some point, it's the message. They were trying to sell a brand, send a message or sell a message, and they were not successful, at least at the gubernatorial level, in terms of doing it. And so a lot of, again, what this book is about is rules that seem to endure. Basically, no matter what the communication technologies, what are the basic rules for winning politics?
In our last minute, David, flip things around. A voter is listening. How do they try to see through the images that campaigns are creating?
This comes the tougher one here is in terms of how do they sort through a lot of the stuff here. You know, originally the show was going to be about a piece that I did in a local newspaper saying about my argument against polling during elections. I would start off by saying first, ignore any polls that are out there. Don't pay attention because they're a distraction. Try to figure out ways of going beyond the social media. Read across lots of reputable sources of news. And maybe almost ask the basic question here. If a candidate is promising something too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
My pleasure, and thank you to the listeners.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today sharing his new book. It's called Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Politainment. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, former Wisconsin Congressional Representative Reed Ribble joins the show for a look at his Republican Party, the midterm election result, and the future of politics in the state and around the country. And NASA launched the Artemis probe over the weekend, the first in a series of planned moon missions coming after some delays. We'll check out the launch and the future of moon exploration, including a possible return of humans to the lunar surface. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, experiencing a mental illness can be a lonely experience, but it doesn't have to be. A mental health expert joins us to talk about the importance of peer support and understanding that you are not alone. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look back at anger in the year 2022. What got people mad? Concerns about what may feel like growing hostility and how we can address it. First, if you've ever dealt with depression, bipolar disorder, or another mental health problem, your own or in your family, you truly are not alone, though it may feel like it. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, 1 in 5 American adults will experience a mental illness. But regardless of the numbers, dealing with mental health can be a lonely or isolating experience. Our next guest has provided treatment for decades. In a new book, he offers advice, resources, and hope, and lessons he's learned from people living with mental health conditions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is your story or someone in your family, what were some of the ways, hopefully, you were able to find connections with others? Was there advice or a skill or a mechanism that helped you have a happier life or a family member have a happier life? Do you have questions for our guest about finding resources, making connections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Ken Duckworth is the Chief Medical Officer for the National Alliance on Mental Illness and author of the book You Are Not Alone, The NAMI Guide to Navigating Mental Health, with advice from experts and wisdom from real people and families. Dr. Duckworth, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
I want to go to your origin story in some ways. This book you've written is a book I think you wish your family had access to when you were a kid and your father was dealing with mental illness. Can you tell a little bit about that story and that inspiration?
Yes, Tyler, this is exactly the book that I could have used, Rob. You know, my family felt so alone. My dad was carted off by the police when I was 7 or 8 years old in Philadelphia. And not long after, we're in a U-Haul driving to Michigan. And 7-year-old me is like, does this have anything to do with that? And so we moved to Michigan, and I'm a proud Big Ten graduate, not of the University of Wisconsin, I should say. But my experience of this was there was so much silence and shame around my dad's illness. My dad was loving and kind. So because I was trying to make sense of it, Rob, I decided to go to medical school and I'll learn everything I could about it. And when I go to bookstores, I still only see memoirs, which are interesting but not practical, and textbooks, which no one reads. How do I know that, Rob? I write chapters in textbooks. And I think, and no one ever reads them. I think it would have helped my family to see other people like me. So this is the book that I wanted for my own life. And it's a gift that Nami allowed me to write it for the rest of us. It's full of ordinary people, people like you and me, carpenters, teachers, policemen, doctors who are living with mental health conditions or in their families. They use their names because shame has been such a primary problem in delaying help seeking, Rob. So this is the book I always wanted for myself. And happily, Nami now has this book.
And a key theme in your book is the title of the book, You Are Not Alone. Anybody experiencing this, especially maybe a decade, 2 decades ago, this was a unique experience for them. Something, as you're saying, people don't talk about. You're hoping, I think, that that's changing, and you're hoping to change that.
That's exactly right, Rob. No matter who you are, there's people from 11 different race and ethnicities, 50 different occupations, 25 religious affiliation, and 38 states, including your fair state of Wisconsin. People share what they've learned, what they've been through, how they've managed, how they figured out how to communicate. The idea is there is expertise in real people, that if you've lived with bipolar disorder for 15 years, you've probably learned something.
And you talk about the idea of recovery. This is something you learned very directly from people dealing with mental health conditions. The importance of, you know, if I'm suffering from something like this, that I help set the terms of what recovery means to me. Can you talk about the value of that?
Yeah, the idea that each person has their own definition of recovery, and whether that's stability, the ability to give to others, the ability to function in relationships. You know, that's a North Star for people. This is what I want. This is what I value. And I asked each of the 70 or so people with first-person experience what their definition of recovery was. And there's a whole chapter called Themes of Recovery. I just listened to people. What does it mean to you, this recovery journey? I also talked to about 60 families of people with mental health conditions. And some people said, you know, I have bipolar disorder, and my spouse is dealing with addiction. So I'm a family member and I have a first person experience.
Talking to Dr. Ken Duckworth, author of the new book, You Are Not Alone, The NAMI Guide to Navigating Mental Health with advice from experts and wisdom from real people and families. If you're willing, you can share your maybe experience, your own or family members at 800-642-1234. Was there something that helped you? Was there a challenge getting help that you needed? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Duckworth, you talk about what may be an underutilized resource, peer support, the value of people dealing with similar things, helping each other out. What is out there? How can we make better use of it?
Yeah, one of the things that came really clear to me, Rob, is what the value of people with similar conditions. I had a chapter I was going to call The Power of Community, and it would have been malpractice not to change it to The Powers of Peers and Community, because so many people told me that a person who's living with, let's say, schizophrenia, coach them on how to manage voices, or a person living with depression, coach them on how to parent while struggling. That the professional world is very valuable. This is a both and book. You know, I like professionals. I like psychotherapy. I think medication is a useful tool much of the time. But the thing that we've overlooked somehow is the wisdom gained from real people who've lived with things. And so all I did was ask them what they'd learned. And it turns out there's about 2,000 years of lived experience in this book, 130 people dealing with things for 15 to 20 years on average. 2,000 years, that's a lot of time. Becoming a peer and helping others is a very profound theme for a lot of people. The idea that they could bring meaning to their experience of suffering is extremely powerful and often very healing. And in helping others, we, of course, help ourselves.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Eau Claire. Bob, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Bob?
I want to tell you about my experience. I went through a master's degree program, and I was suffering from severe chronic depression and never told anyone. I could have received an Oscar for my acting award.
Mm.
But yet when I found this peer recovery center in Eau Claire, just the ability for me to talk about what was going on and to feel safe about it and not to scare anybody about it because they had all been through it changed my life incredibly.
Bob, I'm so glad to hear that you had that experience.
Bob, thanks a lot for sharing that. Dr. Duckworth, can you talk about if somebody's listening and saying, I want what Bob got there, how do they go about finding some kind of peer support network like Bob found?
Well, I don't know how Bob found it in Eau Claire, but NAMI Wisconsin is a strong NAMI affiliate. The first NAMI meeting in 1979 was actually in Wisconsin. And what I want to say to people is Bob is one of tens of thousands of people that has benefited from a peer support culture. It's so powerful, and it isn't something professionals particularly understand. I say this as a card-carrying psychiatrist. We have undervalued the power of peers and the power of learning from each other. So, Bob, I want to thank you for sharing what you have learned, and I'm delighted to hear that it was so helpful to you.
And thanks again for sharing that with us, Bob. I appreciate that. Dr. Duckworth, in the book you talk about, NAMI itself offers some things like this. There are clubhouses. I know some of my friends work at Fountain House in New York City. We have clubhouses in Wisconsin. Could you talk about some of the more formal peer support things like that and some of the informal ones you write about?
I interviewed someone from Fountain House because it's the original community clubhouse, right? There's more than 400 clubhouses across the world, and they're undoubtedly throughout every major city in Wisconsin. And this is a social organization where people can find connection and people who care about them. And I think it's really important that you can be part of a community. So I interviewed them because in the 1940s, when they closed a big state hospital in New York, a group of people that had been meeting at the state hospital said they called their group We Are Not Alone, or WANA. They've wanted to feel part of a community. And so as I researched that, that isn't a fact I knew. I knew of Fountain House, of course. Every community psychiatrist knows of Fountain House. I was so touched that their idea of how to conceptualize their work was as We Are Not Alone. NAMI also has support groups, and they have a peer-to-peer support group. So if you contact NAMI Wisconsin, a very strong affiliate, you will find resources for families and for individuals, both in terms of formal classes and also support groups in person and online.
We're talking to Dr. Ken Duckworth, Chief Medical Officer at NAMI, with us today to talk about his new book. It's called You Are Not Alone, The NAMI Guide to Navigating Mental Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have an experience to share, your own or maybe in your family, or a question for our guest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our conversation with Dr. Ken Duckworth, Chief Medical Officer for NAMI. His new book is You Are Not Alone, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I got a TBI, traumatic brain injury, on June 9th of 21, and the thing that helped me greatly is the Facebook groups. They kind of tell me, like, what to expect and what, because I'm on so many different drugs. I ask their opinion about drugs and stuff, it's been a nightmare. I'd rather have lost a limb than have the brain injury. But, like, I just got out of the ER for a headache. I get headaches every day. It's been ridiculous. But the support on the Facebook groups is huge for me.
Nick, thanks for the call. Sorry you've experienced this. Dr. Duckworth, no, sorry.
Sorry to hear that. It sounds like you're crowdsourcing both support and input, Nick. And this is one of the things I think we need to do because we have such a shortage of licensed professionals. I like licensed professionals, but I'm glad you're also getting support from a community. And I thank you for calling in. I think this is a underappreciated aspect of healing.
Thanks a lot for that call. I know, Dr. Duckworth, when we start to search for things on the internet, we may find a good support group that's really helpful. We may find things that steer us in weird directions. Do you have advice on navigating that?
Boy, that's a good question. Well, again, I like NAMI Wisconsin. They're reputable. They're thoughtful. They've been at it since 1979, where the first NAMI convention was held. They might be a good resource to start with. And if they can't provide you what you need, I bet they can help you find what you need.
Thanks again for sharing your story. Suzanne joins us now in Madison. Suzanne, hello. Oops, Suzanne, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, what did you want to share with us?
Well, I just want to say I first heard Dr. Duckworth talk about his book at a NAMI conference last year, and I'm glad it's come out. And today I had the privilege of celebrating my 37-year-old son's birthday with him. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was 17. And today he is in recovery. He lives alone. He works alone. He owns a car that he makes payments on and maintains. He travels on his own. And recovery is real. And I really want to get that message out that we just have to sometimes wait a long time for it. And it took our son over 12 years until he was ready to really work on recovery. And it's a tough illness, and having mental illness is very tough, and families just have to give absolute love and absolute support. I'm also a family-to-family teacher for NAMI.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Suzanne. Dr. Duckworth.
Suzanne, thank you for everything you're doing, and happy birthday to your son at 37. I find a lot of people find a path. Not every path is the same. And it usually isn't quick. And so thank you for teaching family to family. Rob, this is a program NAMI has developed, which has been demonstrated in randomized controlled trials to increase hope and empowerment for family members who have adult children with serious mental health conditions. So Suzanne, congratulations on you and your son's success, and I wish you all the best.
Suzanne, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Dr. Duckworth, you say that, you know, in the darkest moments, someone experiencing a schizophrenia or major depression or bipolar disorder, things might look hopeless for them and their family members. You are really hoping to highlight stories like Suzanne to say things are bad now, but they can get better.
Here's other people who have been in this place, did not see a way out, and they found a path. And again, for an acute crisis, you'd still want to contact 988, which is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and not NAMI Wisconsin. So if you're in an acute moment of desperation and you need an acute crisis, that isn't a NAMI resource. That's a national crisis counseling line. But I think it's really important to reflect upon the fact of the number of people who do well. And Rob, I also see this among practitioners who work in hospitals. They see people when they're sick and they don't get to watch the whole movie of the person living independently, having a job, having relationships, having a car. They may be taking medicines. They may still have symptoms, right? We don't have cures, but we do have a series of meaningful lives.
Thanks again for that call. We are talking to Dr. Ken Duckworth. His new book is called You Are Not Alone. Back to your calls now. Andy is with us in Green Bay. Andy, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm an alcoholic, and at one of my group meetings, I brought up the fact that I deal with depression. And it was amazing to me the number of people around the room that are also dealing with depression. And my question is, Does depression lead to addiction, or does addiction lead to depression?
What a fantastic question.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think the short answer is we don't know. But we do know that there are co-travelers. And we also know that the cultures of the approaches in mental health and addiction support can be in conflict. So I interviewed a bunch of people who were told in AA, for example, not in every AA group, I like AA, you know, to not take medicines. And I talked to people in the mental health space who were told, you know, until you get your addiction under control, we can't treat your depression. So these are two different cultures. The truth is we don't know why they co-travel. We do know that they do co-travel. And we have to be respectful of the idea that each culture has a tradition and has come to that place for their own reasons, but we have to be able to integrate them. You need to be able to deal with your addiction and your depression at the same time.
Andy, and thanks. For,
yeah, thanks, Andy.
Andy, thanks and best as you deal with both of those problems. Dr. Duckworth, one of the most striking things to me was your chapter on advocacy and how people dealing with mental illness, one of the most powerful things that helped them was helping other people.
I want to say each of the people who called in today is an advocate. Mm-hmm. They're sharing their experience so that someone else feels less alone. Again, advocacy is a critical aspect for many people of taking it to the next level. And I love the idea that changing something, you know, advocating for more resources or testifying at the state legislature or coaching another person as a peer specialist, becoming a sponsor in AA. These are all advocacy steps. It solidifies the person's own experience of recovery and extends beyond. I think that's a critical aspect for many people. I don't think every person has to do this. I just heard it in so many of my interviews. It was really powerful for me.
Dr. Duckworth, we just have a couple minutes left. Now, people dealing with mental health problems, their own or in the family, they may be at a lot of different points in that story. If they haven't taken a first step to reach out and find connections, what would you say to hopefully help inspire them?
Well, you have a variety of resources. And, you know, clubhouses are one. NAMI Wisconsin's another. AA is another. There's a lot of people who are interested in supporting your recovery. And remember, a life in a snapshot is not a life in a movie. And when I see somebody who's 17 years old and is struggling with suicidality, particularly if they like baseball, I like to remind them that they're in the first or second inning of a 9-inning game. And, you know, here in Boston, we have the Red Sox. We had a terrible season. If you're down 3 runs in the first inning, the game really isn't over. It really isn't over. And finding other people who've been where you've been and can offer you some support, suggestions, tips, pointers, and love, you know, is often a really great tool. For the book, all the royalties go to NAMI. This is a love gift on my part for my father and for everyone like him, you know, because I hadn't seen a book where real people share what they learned. And so this is something I gave to NAMI as a love gift.
Dr. Duckworth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Dr. Ken Duckworth, Chief Medical Officer for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. He joined us to talk about his new book, You Are Not Alone, The NAMI Guide to Navigating Mental Health with Advice from Experts and Wisdom from Real People and Families. A couple numbers for you. Dr. Duckworth mentioned the crisis hotline, the suicide prevention hotline. That's 988. For non-acute crises, the NAMI hotline, he mentioned, you can call or text 800-950-6264. That's 800-950-6264. Coming up after the news, 2022 was, among other things, what felt like, anyway, a pretty angry year. A Wisconsin psychologist joins the show for a look at the things that made us angry over the last year, how we can turn that anger into something more positive. He says there are good uses for anger if we know how to handle it and what to do with it. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.